Well, I'm sure you've all had a peek at a very, very amazing and, I think, fantastic article that has appeared in one of our Boston papers, written by John H. Luttrell. It's a story of two people from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, who allegedly met, talked to, and were even examined by beings from another planet. And John, we're very happy that you could come in this morning, because I'd like to find out all I can about this.
So would I.
Well, let's start from the beginning. How did you happen to catch on to this story anyway?
Well, it's ironic, Alan, because I fell into it and didn't know what I had, not for several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved talking to someone who in turn had been talking with the hills. This story had been kept pretty much under wraps for a matter of almost 4 years, the first year of necessity, because the hills themselves didn't know what had happened. They aren't still sure what happened, and they are seeing none of what has appeared in the newspapers. But it was the type of story that was so challenging, so provocative, we had to explore it to its fullest possible degree.
Mm-hmm.
And when we managed to get a composite, get everything that we could get without getting the hills themselves, and at this point it must be said that their restraint, their unwillingness to lend themselves to something that could be pure sensationalism, pure out-of-this-world science fiction, is to be commended.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got the story and got it all together, we decided that it was a story that had to be told. And it, like the hills, had to be told in a very restrained manner, if it's to be believed at all. And I think perhaps that's the question that's been asked of us most of all during this past week. Do you believe it? And Alan, I don't know.
You really don't know?
I really don't know. And I don't think that it's my job at all to believe or to disbelieve, because my only talent, my only ability, and certainly my only purpose is to collect all of the facts, to weigh them, to determine their credibility, to prove them or disprove them as much as I can, and then to present them and let the reader, and in this case this morning the listener, make up his or her own mind.
Well, you had to start somewhere, John. And I know you're reluctant, as any newspaper man would be, to divulge all your sources, but I assume they're as authentic as they can be.
They are, certainly. They are, certainly.
For the sake of those, John, who might have just joined, excuse me for interrupting, and perhaps have not read the article, why don't we briefly tell them what this is all about in a nutshell, then we'll get back to particulars.
In a nutshell, it's sort of a three-part sequence. Number one, Mr. and Mrs. Hill returning from vacation in Canada to their home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire via Franconia Notch on Route 3 shortly before midnight on the night of September 19th, 1961, saw a strange object in the sky. Its maneuverings, its brilliance, so attracted their attention, they stopped, got out of their car, and looked at it. And it zoomed in that direction and then zoomed away, and as if it were cavorting playfully in the skies. And you can just watch something like this for so long, and what else can you do? So they got back into their car.
Mm-hmm.
And they proceeded down Route 3. And this is now in the general area between Indian Head and Groveton. And now they became aware of this thing hovering directly over that car at a much lower altitude. And they became aware of strange sounds emanating from the trunk area of that car. Sounds that we might describe as a beep, but yet if you were to really describe it, it might be that, say, of a tuning fork.
Mm-hmm.
It twanged. Again, they stopped the car. Now, they had binoculars with them. They had them for vacation purposes. They didn't have them especially along because they hoped to see something in the sky. They just were there. And now they got out of the car, and they became aware of this thing, whatever it was, illuminated brilliantly from within, but casting no light outside, hovering perhaps 100 feet, the equivalent of a 10-story building, almost directly over their car, but perhaps a bit off to the side of the road. Now, Mr. Hill, using the binoculars, recalls being able to see movement, see life, and to actually discern the presence of figures, people moving around through two rows of glass windows. Now, this in and of itself was such an unnerving sight that by Mr. Hill's own admission to his friends and to a gathering of the UFO study group in Quincy not too long ago, he panicked and he ran back to his car in sheer absolute horror and tried to speed away from this object. So much for the second part. The third and most fantastic part is something that the Hills, until they underwent hypnotic therapy, had no conscious memory of at all. And this is later on, perhaps 10 or 15 minutes or maybe 10 or 15 miles down the road, in rounding a curve to the left, became aware of this immense, well, what seemed to be an orange ball glowing in the woods off the highway. And that car suddenly rolled to a complete stop. The engine simply failed. And as the car rolled to a stop, several men formed a cordon, a human roadblock, and they tried starting the car to get away from these people. They were certainly very, very frightened. And the men surrounded the car, opened the doors, took them out, guided them in a path through the woods to the source of this light that purported to be a spaceship, had conversation with them, tried to allay their fears
in English.
One man spoke English, or is purported to have spoken English. Again, there is no proof whether there was an actual conversation or whether this was a transmission of thought waves, telepathy, or something of the sort. Mrs. Hill's best memory as a result of hypnotic treatment is that there was an actual conversation, because she recalls speaking.
John, I think also at this point we should bring out that even though this occurred in the year 1961, this thing didn't come to a head so that you got the story until Mrs. Hill was having bad dreams, nightmares so terrible that she went to psychiatrist. That's how it all began, isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And she ended up by going where finally?
She was finally referred professionally to one of the country's outstanding psychohypnotists here in Boston. And therein began a series of hypnotic treatments. And for the uninformed, for people who think that hypnosis is just a theatrical act, someone sitting on the edge of a stage and another one dangling a watch in front of them, and hopefully to make them stand on their heads and draw a great big crowd reaction. Hypnosis today is used quite professionally, not only to get at the very basis of psychiatric problems, it's also used to alleviate the pains of childbirth, it's used extensively in dentistry. It has become now a science in its own right.
Well, now, she, of course, didn't realize at the time that she had made this contact, and this was brought out through the psychiatric treatment, correct?
That's correct.
Now, you say that when he first began to question her, he went back regressively, actually, day by day by day.
Yes, that ultimately was the course that he pursued. It was apparent in the case of both Mr. Hill and Mr. Hill, who shared a common experience. Both were made to undergo hypnosis separately.
I see. And did he get the same answers, apparently, from both?
Essentially, yes.
That's amazing. Did he also have nightmares?
No, Mr. Hill himself didn't.
And yet he didn't recall this happening until he went to the psychiatrist, is that correct?
Yes, and not for some many, many months afterwards. In fact, between the time that this is purported to have happened until the time that the doctor was able to sit down and discuss with the Hills what he was able to draw from them, well over a year had elapsed.
That brought us up to 62.
Well into 62.
And the story apparently was hidden in the privateness of the doctor's office. And you somehow got wind, and I won't, try and find out how.
Well, you've got to bear in mind this. It is is the best therapy in the world when anyone has anything of an emotional nature bottled up within them, to talk about it.
Will they talk about it?
Yes, they do. And they have been talking about it for quite some time. They haven't been talking about it in a showman-like way. This is something that they've had in private discussions with their own circle of friends. But if you were to have heard this story firsthand from a couple to whom this is supposed to have happened, how long could you keep quiet about it? How long could anybody keep quiet about it?
That's true.
It's so exciting, so fascinating. It's a thing that you want to tell other people. And ultimately, this is how I got it. And I got it without any names, without any dates, without any times, just a general story. And a story that the person wanted to tell me more in entertaining fashion than anything else, because he didn't believe it, but he thought it might be good for laughs, for kicks. And knowing of these rather strange things that have happened since the advent of the space age, nothing now is impossible, Alan.
That's true. I have my own thoughts.
Let us quickly go back to our own childhood. And we sat for hours in this little dream world that we created, reading Buck Rogers, reading Flash Gordon. And here, within the span of our own lifetime, these things that were so far, far away have now achieved reality.
Oh, I agree. 100%.
So now nothing is impossible. And the whole thing, it sounded so way out. You know, was it worth going into? And I decided to go into it. And this involved a tremendous amount of research, narrowing down the field of sightings to what could have corresponded to this general story. And then I got into the area of people that had specific information. And again, these people didn't want to disclose the name of the hills. They wanted to protect them. They didn't want to expose them to anything that would border on public ridicule. And it took some doing to find out who these people were. And then to talk with them, to try to persuade them that the best interest of the general public would be served by them coming forward gratuitously in cooperating and telling this whole story. And this they didn't want to do. They didn't want to do because, frankly, they thought they would be laughed right out of their own communities. And this they couldn't afford to do.
That's right.
Mrs. Hill is a professional person, a person of great capability, a person described by her supervisor, the New Hampshire State Department of Health and Welfare, as one of the most talented, most dedicated women he's ever had, and a person whose emotional stability is just unquestioned. You know, this woman is solid. Her husband, too, is very much a pillar of his community, of his church. Excuse me. So, whether or not it be in the interest of science, or whether or not it be furthering something from which they may, to a degree, believe, they had to lay their lifetime on the right on the line. They had to be willing to gamble that people wouldn't laugh at them.
I don't think anyone has laughed, John.
No.
And I'd like to ask you a couple more questions, but we do have a commercial word right here now. It's 16 minutes after 11. John Luttrell, our guest, and we're talking about one of the most amazing happenings of our time.
Doggone, for that young man, I gotta get to bed, man.
If you can't say anything nice about your present cigarette, come on over to the L&M side, just for the taste of it. That taste.
Terrific.
The L&M side is for people who want taste in a cigarette and plenty of it. Come on over, just for the taste of it.
Come on over, you'll be glad you did. Come on over to the L&M side.
Come on over to the L&M side, just for the taste of it.
Well, John, a moment ago, you were saying that, I think we both agree that no one had laughed about this story. As a matter of fact, things today can happen. As you pointed out, the last 50 years have brought changes that no one would believe would happen, but they have. So anything is believable. But let's get back to this couple now. You were saying,
well, in the sequence of the story that unfolds under hypnosis, the people were taken aboard the spaceship. They were subjected separately and simultaneously to a complete physical and intellectual examination, questioned closely about life on Earth, then reassured that they would have no conscious memory of this, and if they did, the memories would be so contradictory that this would set up a pattern of confusion in their own minds, and this is something that they wouldn't even want to talk about to one another. They were taken back to their car. And now that conscious memory resumes. Uh-huh. It resumes many, many miles down the road, now on Route 4 near Plymouth.
Uh-huh.
And they got home.
There had to be a time lapse in there.
Oh, something. Yes. There was a full two-hour time lapse that they couldn't explain. And this lapse didn't really dawn on them then.
Uh-huh.
Because the last thing they had consciously remembered was getting away from this thing that was hovering over their car. And it wasn't for some while afterwards, probably well into the next day, that they became aware that somewhere along the line, 2 hours just dropped inexplicably out of their lives. What happened to it? At this point, they had a decision. They had seen what appeared to be a spaceship, a UFO, a thing. First, from a distance, secondly, up close. Should they tell anybody about this? Because no matter how well-intentioned people are, there's always the risk of being laughed at, and nobody ever likes to be laughed at.
True.
So they decided that they were going to fulfill whatever obligation they had, and they called the Pease Air Force Base in nearby Newington. They live in Portsmouth. And they decided that they would tell the Air Force only the first part.
That they had sighted something.
That they had sighted something. They were able to give an excellent description of its maneuvering, its direction, the size that it assumed. And I think the Air Force, as a good rule of thumb, asks you to hold a round object in your hand at arm's length, be it a dime, a quarter, an orange, a grapefruit. And correspondingly, how big did this appear at varying times? Well, it was the size of a dime at one point, was the size of a quarter at another point, the size of an orange at another point. And the Air Force was very, very interested, very, very much so. Yet, they never bothered to come out and interview the Hills personally. They did this all by telephone within the next day or two. But then a strange thing happened. It was, perhaps a week or two after this, perhaps a little longer. This is something I just cannot pinpoint. One of the base intelligence officers, on a person-to-person basis, somehow contrived the acquaintance and then the confidence of the Hills and got to talk with them. And it's my understanding that this officer also became a member of that church and had occasion to run into them socially at church gatherings, church meetings. And in a very adroit fashion began to pump these people. And in fact offered a little information of his own about the general subject of UFO sightings, hoping that this would entice these people to tell him a little bit more. But Barney Hill is himself a very astute gentleman. And he sensed that there was a reason for this. And immediately his defenses went up, and I guess the officer sort of sensed this and the relationship broke off. But this is an experience that is completely, thoroughly out of this world, but yet in so many ways so believable, so credible, and so much so that now in the year 1965, in the week just ended, we know that there have been innumerable teachers and, in fact, principals of entire schools that have made this series must reading for children under either current events or under science. And these children, hopefully, are going to be asked to prepare essays on whether or not they believe there's life in other worlds.
It's an amazing story, John. We'll be back talking a little bit more about it right after this word.
Tonight, one out of six drivers will be riding with a burned-out light, and most of them won't know it. General Electric suggests you check your lights or ask the man who services your car. Check them this easy way.
Push, pull, push, pull, drivers, push your brake and pull out the light switch. Check all your lights and see if you find a burned out light in your car. Replace it with a lamp made by GE. General Electric lamps. Push, pull, push, pull.
All right, time now on the Allen Derry Sunday Show, about 23 and a half minutes after 11, and our guest for this half hour is John Luttrell, who really wrote an amazing story in one of our local papers, and of course, we're trying to get a little more info out of him. I don't know if we've provided anything additionally, you know, from the article, John, but when you talk about UFOs, the question is always asked. For example, I'm very interested in the subject. Someone will ask me, do you really believe that there's life in this universe other than on Earth? And I can't help but believe, as I look up into the heavens at night and see the multitude of galaxies and stars and moons and suns that are up there, that there has to be life somewhere else. It just all isn't there for looking at. So when a story like this comes out in a newspaper, I, of course, like everybody else, scratch my head and say, well, maybe, maybe not. But I think it's so plausible that people really can't see their nose in spite of it, if you know what I mean. How do you feel?
I think there's every reasonable assumption based upon good, solid common sense that, yes, there are existences, there are other worlds about which we know nothing. And look at the response of the best scientific brains that our country and this world have to offer. And you'll find the sharp division right down the middle of the scientific community.
Believers and non-believers.
Believers and non-believers.
Yeah.
The non-believers essentially are those people who are so conservative that they absolutely have to have proof that just cannot be challenged. And perhaps this is a good thing. This is a good thing. And I think it's a good thing, Al, that there are enough of their contemporaries, there are enough perhaps people like ourselves who are on the tails of the others just so they will never give up. There is so much to be learned, and I think perhaps we are just now standing on the threshold of a brilliant new existence that man in his wildest dreams could never envision. I think it's there.
You know, we had Ray Fowler on a couple of weeks ago. He's with NICAP. And I asked him about the same question. Did he believe there was actual visitors coming from outer space? And he more or less said yes, he did. He said that there were just too many unexplained sightings. You know, many of them they'll explain off as a balloon or a natural phenomenon of some sort. But he said there are just too many that even the government can't put their finger on. And I'd like to read the minds of some of these people who have the dope on these, this 10% perhaps that's unexplained. Do you think they're holding anything back from us?
Al, that's a loaded question.
Yeah, I know.
But let me unload it this way. It appears apparent to me from what I've read, and I can only offer this opinion as a non-scientific person. I'm a newspaper man. I'm a reporter with some God-given talents to be able to write. But I'm no scientist. And
he's not unloading on this one too quickly. Well, I don't know either, and I don't think Ray Fowler really knows, but it seems sometimes, Ray said to me, for example, he said, you know, let's assume there were visitors from somewhere. He said, do you think that people are ready to accept it? Would they panic? Would they get frightened? What do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think back in, I think it was it 38 or 39, when Orson Welles came out with The War of the Worlds, people were not as sophisticated as they are now. Now, today, the firing of a rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California...
It's met with complete complacency.
Complete complacency. It's just another thing. And I think people are sophisticated enough, but I think that most of them are still thirsting for an answer.
I do, too.
Well, why don't we just let it sit right there, John? Some things are just unexplainable right now.